At nightfall, we'll have to make do with sleeping on those smelly mats at the Pack Horse Driver's Inn in Xinggu, although not sleeping at all might be better than that. We need our sleep now more than ever. Let's get going, said Gonroku, rising to his feet and clutching the new straw hat he had just bought. But wait just a minute.
Why?
I want to fill this bamboo tube with drinking water. Going around behind the building, he submerged his tube in a clear running brook till the bubbles stopped rising to the surface. Walking back toward the road in front, he glanced through a side window into the dim interior of the tea house. Suddenly, he came to a halt, surprised to see a figure lying on the floor, covered with straw matting. The smell of medicine permeated the air. Gonroku couldn't see the face, but he could discern long black hair strewn every which way on the pillow.
"Uncle Gong, hurry up!"
Osugi cried impatiently. "Coming!"
"What kept you?"
"There seems to be a sick person inside," he said, walking behind her like a chastened dog.
"What's so unusual about that? You're as easy to distract as a child."
"Sorry, sorry," he apologized hastily. He was as intimidated by Osugi as anyone else, but knew better than most how to manage her. They set off down the fairly steep hill leading to the Harima Road. The road, used daily by pack horses from the silver mines, was pitted with potholes.
"Don't fall down, Granny," Gong advised.
"How dare you patronize me? I can walk on this road with my eyes closed. Be careful yourself, you old fool."
Just then, a voice greeted them from behind.
"You two are pretty spry, aren't you?"
They turned to see the owner of the tea house on horseback.
"Oh, yes. We just had a rest at your place, thank you. And where are you off to?"
"Tatsuno."
"At this hour?"
"There's no doctor between here and there. Even on horseback, it'll take me at least till midnight."
"Is it your wife who's sick?"
"Oh, no," his brows knitted. "If it were my wife or one of the children, I wouldn't mind. But it's a lot of trouble to go to for a stranger, someone who just stopped in to take a rest."
"Oh," said Uncle Gong.
"Is it the girl in your back room? I happened to glance in and see her."
Osugi's brows now knitted as well.
"Yes," the shopkeeper said. "While she was resting, she started shivering, so I offered her the back room to lie down in. I felt I had to do something. Well, she didn't get any better. In fact, she seems much worse. She's burning up with fever. Looks pretty bad."
Osugi stopped in her tracks.
"Is the girl about 16 and very slender?"
"Yes, about 16, I'd say. Says she comes from Miyamoto."
Osugi, winking at Gonroku, began poking around in her obi. A look of distress came over her face as she exclaimed,
"Oh, I've left them back at the tea house."
"Left what?"
"My prayer beads. I remember now. I put them down on a stool." "Oh, that's too bad," said the shopkeeper, turning his horse around. "I'll go back for them."
"Oh, no. You've got to fetch the doctor. That sick girl's more important than my beads. We'll just go back and pick them up ourselves."
Uncle Gong was already on his way, striding rapidly back up the hill. As soon as Osugi disposed of the solicitous tea-house owner, she hurried to catch up. Before long, they were both puffing and panting. Neither spoke. It had to be Otsu. Otsu had never really shaken off the fever she caught the night they dragged her in out of the storm. Somehow, she forgot about feeling sick during the few hours she was with Takezo. But after he left her, she'd walked only a short way before beginning to give in to pain and fatigue. By the time she got to the tea house, she felt miserable. She did not know how long she had been lying in the back room, deliriously begging for water time and time again. Before leaving, the shopkeeper had looked in on her and urged her to try to stick it out. Moments later, she had forgotten he'd ever spoken to her. Her mouth was parched. She felt as if she had a mouthful of thorns.
"Master, water, please," she called out feebly.
Hearing no reply, she raised herself on her elbows and craned her neck toward the water basin just outside the door. Slowly she managed to crawl to it, but as she put her hand on the bamboo dipper at the side, she heard a rain shutter fall to the ground somewhere behind her. The tea house was little more than a mountain hut to begin with, and there was nothing to prevent anyone from simply lifting out any or all of the loosely fitted shutters. Osugi and Uncle Gon stumbled in through the opening.
"I can't see a thing," complained the old woman in what she thought was a whisper.
"Wait a minute,"
Gon replied, heading toward the hearth room where he stirred up the embers and threw on some wood to get a bit of light.
"She's not in here, Granny."
"She must be. She can't have gotten away."
Almost immediately, Osugi noticed that the door in the back room was ajar.
"Look, out there!" she shouted.
Otsu, who was standing just outside, threw the dipper full of water through the narrow opening into the old woman's face and sped downhill like a bird in the wind, sleeves and skirt trailing behind her. Osugi ran outside and spat out an imprecation.
"Gong! Gong! Do something! Do something!"
"Did she get away?"
"Of course she did. We certainly gave her enough warning, making all that noise. You would have to drop the shutter."
The old woman's face contorted with rage.
"Can't you do something?"
Uncle Gon directed his attention to the deer-like form flying in the distance. He raised his arm and pointed.
"That's her, right? Don't worry, she doesn't have much of a head start. She's sick, and anyway, she only has the legs of a girl. I'll catch up with her in no time."
He tucked his chin in and broke into a run. Osugi followed close behind.
"Uncle Gong," she cried, "you can use your sword on her, but don't cut off her head until after I've had a chance to give her a piece of my mind."
Uncle Gon suddenly let out a scream of dismay and fell to his hands and knees.
"What's the matter?"
cried Osugi, coming up behind him.
"Look down!"
Osugi did. Directly in front of them was a steep drop into a bamboo-covered ravine.
"She dived into that?"
"Yes. I don't think it's very deep, but it's too dark to tell. I'll have to go back to the tea house and get a torch."
As he knelt staring into the ravine, Osugi cried,
"What are you waiting for, you dolt?"
and gave him a violent shove. There was the sound of feet trying to gain a footing, scrambling desperately before coming to a stop at the bottom of the ravine.
"You old witch!" shouted Uncle Gong angrily. "Now just get on down here yourself. See how you like it."
Takezo, arms folded, sat atop a large boulder and stared across the valley at the Hinagura stockade. Under one of those roofs, he reflected, his sister was imprisoned. But he'd sat there from dawn to dusk the previous day and all day today, unable to devise a plan to get her out. He intended to sit until he did. His thinking had progressed to the point where he was confident he could outmaneuver the 50 or 100 soldiers guarding the stockade, but he continued to ponder the lay of the land. He had to get not only in, but out. It was not encouraging. Behind the stockade was a deep gorge, and at the front, the road into the stockade was well protected by a double gate. To make matters worse, the two of them would be forced to flee across a flat plateau, which offered not a single tree to hide behind. On a cloudless day such as this, a better target would be hard to find. The situation thus called for a night assault, but he'd observed that the gates were closed and locked before sunset. Any attempt to jimmy them open would doubtless set off a cacophonous alarm of wooden clappers. There seemed no foolproof way to approach the fortress.
"There's no way," Takezo thought sadly. "Even if I just took a long shot, risked my life and hers, it wouldn't work."
He felt humiliated and helpless.
"How," he asked himself, "did I get to be such a coward? A week ago, I wouldn't have even thought about the chances of getting out alive."
For another half day, his arms remained folded over his breast as if locked. He feared something he couldn't define and hesitated getting any closer to the stockade. Time and time again, he upbraided himself.
I've lost my nerve. I never used to be this way. Maybe staring death in the face makes cowards out of everyone. He shook his head. No, it wasn't that, not cowardice. He had simply learned his lesson, the one Takuan had taken so much trouble to teach, and could now see things more clearly. He felt a new calm, a sense of peace. It seemed to flow in his breast like a gentle river. Being brave was very different from being ferocious. He saw that now. He didn't feel like an animal. He felt like a man. A courageous man who's outgrown his adolescent recklessness. The life that had been given to him was something to be treasured and cherished, polished and perfected. He stared at the lovely clear sky, whose color alone seemed a miracle. Still, he could not leave his sister stranded, even if it meant violating one last time the precious self-knowledge he'd so recently and painfully acquired. A plan began to take shape. After nightfall, I'll cross the valley and climb the cliff on the other side. The natural barrier may be a blessing in disguise. There's no gate at the back, and it doesn't seem heavily guarded. He had hardly arrived at this decision when an arrow whizzed toward him and thudded into the ground inches from his toes. Across the valley, he saw a crowd of people milling about just inside the stockade. Obviously, they'd spotted him. Almost immediately, they dispersed. He surmised it had been a test shot to see how he'd react, and deliberately remained motionless upon his perch. Before long, the light of the evening sun began to fade behind the peaks of the western mountains. Just before darkness dropped, he arose and picked up a rock. He had spotted his dinner flying in the air over his head. He downed the bird on the first try, tore it apart, and sank his teeth into the warm flesh. While he ate, 20-odd soldiers moved noisily into position and surrounded him. Once in place, they let out a battle cry, one man shouting, "It's Takezo! Takezo from Miyamoto!" "He's dangerous! Don't underestimate him!" someone else warned. Looking up from his feast of raw fowl, Takezo trained a murderous eye on his would-be captors. It was the same look animals flash when disturbed in the midst of a meal. "Yeah!" he yelled, seizing a huge rock and hurling it at the perimeter of this human wall. The rock turned red with blood, and in no time he was over it and away, running straight toward the stockade gate. The men were agape. "What's he doing? Where's the fool going? He's out of his mind!" He flew like a crazed dragonfly, with the war-whooping soldiers in full chase. By the time they reached the outer gate, however, he'd already leapt over it. But now he was between the gates, in what was, in fact, a cage. Takezo's eyes took in none of this. He could see neither the pursuing soldiers, nor the fence, nor the guards inside the second gate. He wasn't even conscious of knocking out, with a single blow, the sentinel who tried to jump him. With almost superhuman strength, he wrenched at a post of the inner gate, shaking it furiously till he was able to pull it out of the ground. Then he turned on his pursuers. He didn't know their number. All he knew was that something big and black was attacking him. Taking aim as best he could, he struck at the amorphous mass with the gatepost. A good number of lances and swords broke, flew into the air, and fell useless to the ground. "Ogin!" cried Takezo, running toward the rear of the stockade. "Ogin! It's me, Takezo!" He glared at the buildings with fiery eyes, calling out repeatedly to his sister. Has it all been a trick? He wondered in panic. One by one, he began battering down doors with the gatepost. The guards' chickens, squawking for dear life, flew in every direction. "Ogin!" When he failed to locate her, his hoarse cries became nearly unintelligible. In the shadows of one of the small, dirty cells, he saw a man trying to sneak away. "Halt!" he shouted, throwing the blood-stained gatepost at the weasel-like creature's feet. When Takezo leaped at him, he began to cry shamelessly. Takezo slapped him sharply on the cheek. "Where's my sister?" he roared. "What have they done to her? Tell me where she is, or I'll beat you to death!" She's not here. Day before yesterday, they took her away. Orders from the castle.
Where, you stupid bastard? Where?
Himeji.
Himeji?
Yes.
If you're lying, I'll...
Takezo grabbed the sniveling mass by its hair.
It's true. True. I swear.
It better be, or I'll come back just for you.
The soldiers were closing in again, and Takezo lifted the man and hurled him at them. Then he disappeared into the shadows of the dingy cells. Half a dozen arrows flew by him, one sticking like a giant sewing needle in the skirt of his kimono. Takezo bit his thumbnail and watched the arrows speed by, then suddenly dashed for the fence and was over it in a flash. Behind him there was a loud explosion. The echo of the gunshot roared across the valley. Takezo sped down the gorge, and as he ran, fragments of Takuan's teachings were racing through his head.
Learn to fear that which is fearsome. Brute strength is child's play, the mindless strength of beasts. Have the strength of the true warrior. Real courage. Life is precious.
The Birth of Musashi. Takezo waited on the outskirts of the castle town of Himeji, sometimes keeping out of sight under Hanada Bridge, but more often standing on the bridge unobtrusively surveying the passersby. When not in the immediate vicinity of the bridge, he would make short excursions around town, careful to keep his hat low and his face concealed, like a beggar's, behind a piece of straw matting. It baffled him that Otsu had not yet appeared. Only a week had gone by since she swore to wait there, not 100, but 1,000 days. Once Takezo had made a promise, he was loath to break it. But with every passing moment, he grew more and more tempted to be on the move, though his promise to Otsu was not the only reason he made his way to Himeji. He also had to find out where they were keeping Ogin. He was near the center of town one day when he heard a voice shouting his name. Footsteps came running after him. He looked up sharply to see Takuan approaching, calling,
"Takezo! Wait!"
Takezo was startled, and as usual, in the presence of this monk, felt slightly humiliated. He had thought his disguise was foolproof and had been sure that no one, not even Takuan, would recognize him. The monk grabbed him by the wrist.
"Come with me,"
he commanded. The urgency in his voice was impossible to ignore.
"And don't make any trouble. I've spent a lot of time looking for you."
Takezo followed meekly. He had no idea where they were going, but he once again found himself powerless to resist this particular man. He wondered why. He was free now, and for all he knew, they were headed straight back to the dreaded tree in Miyamoto, or perhaps into a castle dungeon. He had suspected they had his sister locked up somewhere in the castle's confines, but he hadn't a shred of evidence to back this up. He hoped he was right. If he, too, was taken there, at least they could die together. If they had to die, he could think of no one else he loved enough to share the final moments of precious life with. Himeji Castle loomed before his eyes. He could see now why it was called the White Crane Castle. The stately edifice stood upon huge stone ramparts, like a great and proud bird descended from the heavens. Takuan preceded him across the wide arcing bridge spanning the outer moat. A row of guards stood at attention before the riveted iron gate. The sunlight glancing off their drawn lances made Takezo, for a split second, hesitant to pass. Takuan, without even turning, sensed this, and with a slightly impatient gesture, urged him to keep moving. Passing under the gate turret, they approached the second gate, where the soldiers looked even more tense and alert, ready to fight at a moment's notice. This was the castle of a daimyo. It would take its inhabitants a while to relax and accept the fact that the country was successfully unified. Like many other castles of the time, it was far from accustomed to the luxury of peace. Takuan summoned the captain of the guard.
"I've brought him," he announced.
Handing Takezo over, the monk advised the man to take good care of him as previously instructed, but added,
"Be careful. He's a lion cub with fangs. He's far from tamed. If you tease him, he bites."
Takuan went through the second gate to the central compound, where the daimyo's mansion was located. Apparently, he knew the way well. He needed neither a guide nor directions. He barely raised his head as he walked, and not a soul interrupted his progress. Heeding Takuan's instructions, the captain didn't lay a finger on his charge. He simply asked Takezo to follow him. Takezo silently obeyed. They soon arrived at a bathhouse, and the captain instructed him to go in and get cleaned up. At this point, Takezo's spine stiffened, for he remembered all too well his last bath at Osugi's house and the trap from which he had narrowly escaped. He folded his arms and tried to think, stalling for time and inspecting the surroundings. It was all so peaceful, an island of tranquility where a daimyo could, when not plotting strategies, enjoy the luxuries of life. Soon a servant bearing a black cotton kimono and hakama arrived, bowing and saying politely, "I'll lay these here. You can put them on when you come out." Takezo nearly wept. The outfit included not only a folding fan and some tissue paper, but a pair of long and short samurai swords. Everything was simple and inexpensive, but nothing was lacking. He was being treated like a human being again, and wanted to lift the clean cotton to his face, rub it to his cheek, and inhale its freshness. He turned and entered the bathhouse. Ikeda Terumasa, lord of the castle, leaned on an armrest and gazed out into the garden. He was a short man, with a cleanly shaven head and dark pockmarks lining his face. Although not dressed in formal attire, his countenance was stern and dignified.
"Is that him?"
he asked Takuan, pointing his folding fan.
"Yes, that's him,"
answered the monk with a deferential bow.
"He has a good face. You did well to save him."
"He owes his life to you, your lordship, not me."
"That's not so, Takuan, and you know it. If I just had a handful of men like you under my command, no doubt a lot of useful people would be saved, and the world would be the better for it."
The daimyo sighed.
"My trouble is that all my men think their sole duty is to tie people up or behead them."
An hour later, Takezo was seated in the garden beyond the veranda, his head bowed and his hands resting flat on his knees in an attitude of respectful attentiveness.
"Your name is Shinmen Takezo, isn't it?"
Lord Ikeda asked. Takezo glanced up quickly to see the face of the famous man, then respectfully cast his eyes downward again. "Yes, sir," he answered clearly.
"The House of Shinmen is a branch of the Akamatsu family, and Akamatsu Masanori, as you well know, was once lord of this castle."
Takezo's throat went dry. He was, for once, at a loss for words. Having always thought of himself as the black sheep of the Shinmen family, with no particular feelings of respect or awe for the daimyo, he was nonetheless filled with shame at having brought such complete dishonor on his ancestors and his family name. His face burned.
"What you have done is inexcusable," continued Terumasa in a sterner tone.
"Yes, sir."
"And I am going to have to punish you for it."
Turning to Takuan, he asked,
"Is it true that my retainer, Aoki Tanzaemon, without my leave, promised you that if you captured this man, you could decide and mete out his punishment?"
"I think you can best find that out by asking Tanzaemon directly."
"I've already questioned him."
"Then did you think I would lie to you?"
"Of course not. Tanzaemon has confessed, but I wanted your confirmation. Since he is my direct vassal, his oath to you constitutes one from me. Therefore, even though I am lord of this fief, I have lost my right to penalize Takezo as I see fit. Of course, I will not permit him to go unpunished, but it is up to you what form the punishment is to take."
"Good. That is exactly what I had in mind."
"Then I assume you have given it some thought. Well, what shall we do with him?"
"I think it would be best to place the prisoner in, what shall we say, straitened circumstances for a while."
"And how do you propose to do that?"
"I believe you have somewhere in this castle a closed room, one long rumored to be haunted."
"Yes, I do. The servants refused to enter it, and my retainers avoided it constantly, so it went unused. I now leave it as it is, since there is no reason to open it again."
"But don't you think it's beneath the dignity of one of the strongest warriors in the Tokugawa realm, you, Ikeda Terumasa, to have a room in your castle where a light never shines?"
"I never thought of it that way."
"Well, people think of things like that. It's a reflection on your authority and prestige. I say we should put a light there."
"Hmm.
If you let me make use of that chamber, I'll keep Takezo there until I'm ready to pardon him. He's had enough of living in total darkness. You hear that, don't you, Takezo?"
There was not a peep from Takezo, but Terumasa began laughing and said,
"Fine."
It was obvious from their excellent rapport that Takuang had been telling Aoki Tanzaemon the truth that night at the temple. He and Terumasa, both followers of Zen, seemed to be on friendly, almost brotherly terms.
"After you've taken him to his new quarters, why don't you join me in the tea house?"
Terumasa asked the monk as he rose to leave.
"Oh, are you planning to demonstrate once again how inept you are at the tea ceremony?"
"That's not even fair, Takuang. These days I've really started to get the knack of it. Come along later, and I'll prove to you I'm no longer simply an uncouth soldier. I'll be waiting."
With that, Terumasa retired to the inner part of the mansion. Despite his short stature, he was barely 5 feet tall, his presence seemed to fill the many-storied castle. It was always pitch dark high in the dungeon, where the haunted room was located. There was no calendar here. No spring, no fall, no sounds of everyday life. There was only one small lamp, lighting a pale and sallow-cheeked Takezo. The topography section of Sun Tzu's Art of War lay open on the low table before him. Sun Tzu said, "Among topographical features, there are those that are passable. There are those that suspend. There are those that confine. There are those that are steep. There are those that are distant." Whenever he came to a passage that particularly appealed to him, like this one, he would read it aloud over and over, like a chant. "He who knows the art of the warrior is not confused in his movements. He acts and is not confined." Therefore, Sun Tzu said, "He who knows himself and knows his enemy wins without danger. He who knows the heavens and the earth wins out overall." When his eyes blurred from fatigue, he rinsed them with cool water from a small bowl he kept beside him. If the oil ran low and the lamp wick sputtered, he simply put it out. Around the table was a mountain of books, some in Japanese, some in Chinese. Books on Zen, volumes on the history of Japan. Takezo was virtually buried in these scholarly tomes. They had all been borrowed from Lord Ikeda's collection. When Takuan had sentenced him to confinement, he had said,
"You may read as much as you want. A famous priest of ancient times once said, 'I become immersed in the sacred scriptures and read thousands of volumes. When I come away, I find that my heart sees more than before.' Think of this room as your mother's womb and prepare to be born anew.
If you look at it only with your eyes, you will see nothing more than an unlit, closed cell. But look again, more closely. Look with your mind and think. This room can be the wellspring of enlightenment, the same fountain of knowledge found and enriched by sages in the past. It is up to you to decide whether this is to be a chamber of darkness or one of light.
Takezo had long since stopped counting the days. When it was cold, it was winter. When hot, summer. He knew little more than that. The air remained the same, dank and musty, and the seasons had no bearing on his life. He was almost positive, however, that the next time the swallows came to nest in the dungeon's boarded-over gunslots, it would be the spring of his third year in the womb.
"I'll be 21 years old," he said to himself.
Seized by remorse, he groaned as if in mourning.
"And what have I done in those 21 years?"
Sometimes the memory of his early years pressed in on him unrelentingly, engulfing him in grief. He would wail and moan, flail and kick, and sometimes sob like a baby. Whole days were swallowed up in agony, which, once it subsided, left him spent and lifeless, hair disheveled and heart torn apart. Finally, one day, he heard the swallows returning to the dungeon eaves. Once again, spring had flown from across the seas. Not long after its arrival, a voice, now sounding strange, almost painful to the ears, inquired,
"Takezo, are you well?"
The familiar head of Takuan appeared at the top of the stairs. Startled and much too deeply moved to utter a sound, Takezo grabbed hold of the monk's kimono sleeve and pulled him into the room. The servants who brought his food had never once spoken a word. He was overjoyed to hear another human voice, especially this one.
"I've just returned from a journey," said Takuan. "You're in your third year here now, and I've decided that after gestating this long, you must be pretty well formed."
"I am grateful for your goodness, Takuan. I understand now what you've done. How can I ever thank you?"
"Thank me?" Takuan said incredulously. Then he laughed. "Even though you've had no one to converse with but yourself, you've actually learned to speak like a human being. Good! Today you will leave this place, and as you do so, hug your hard-earned enlightenment to your bosom. You're going to need it when you go forth into the world to join your fellow men."
Takuan took Takezo just as he was to see Lord Ikeda. Although he had been relegated to the garden in the previous audience, a place was now made for him on the veranda. After the salutations and some perfunctory small talk, Terumasa lost no time in asking Takezo to serve as his vassal. Takezo declined. He was greatly honored, he explained, but he did not feel the time was yet right to go into a daimyo's service. "And if I did so in this castle," he said, "ghosts would probably start appearing in the closed room every night, just as everyone says they do."
"Why do you say that? Did they come to keep you company?"
"If you take a lamp and inspect the room closely, you'll see black spots spattering the doors and beams. It looks like lacquer, but it's not. It's human blood, most likely blood spilled by the Akamatsus, my forebears, when they went down to defeat in this castle."
You may very well be right.
Seeing those stains infuriated me. My blood boiled to think that my ancestors, who once ruled over this whole region, ended up being annihilated, their souls just blown about in the autumn winds. They died violently, but it was a powerful clan, and they can be roused. "That same blood flows in my veins," he went on, an intense look in his eyes. "Unworthy though I am a member of the same clan, and if I stay in this castle, the ghosts may rouse themselves and try to reach me.
In a sense, they already have, by making it clear to me in that room just who I am. But they could cause chaos, perhaps rebel and even set off another bloodbath. We are not in an era of peace. I owe it to the people of this whole region not to tempt the vengeance of my ancestors.
Tidumasa nodded.
I see what you mean. It's better if you leave this castle, but where will you go? Do you plan to return to Miyamoto? Live out your life there?
Takezo smiled silently. I want to wander about on my own for a while.
I see,
the lord replied, turning to Takuan.
See that he receives money and suitable clothing, he commanded.
Takuan bowed.
Let me thank you for your kindness to the boy.
Takuan, Ikeda laughed. This is the first time you've ever thanked me twice for anything.
I suppose that's true,
Takuan grinned.
It won't happen again.
It's all right for him to roam about while he's still young, said Tidumasa. But now that he's going out on his own, reborn, as you put it, he should have a new name. Let it be Miyamoto, so that he never forgets his birthplace. From now on, Takezo, call yourself Miyamoto.
Takezo's hands went automatically to the floor. Palms down, he bowed deep and long. Yes, sir, I will do that.
You should change your first name, too,
Takuan interjected.
Why not read the Chinese characters of your name as Musashi instead of Takezo? You can keep writing your name the same as before. It's only fitting that everything should begin anew on this day of your rebirth.
Terumasa, who was by this time in a very good mood, nodded his approval enthusiastically.
Miyamoto Musashi. It's a good name, a very good name. We should drink to it.
They moved into another room, sake was served, and Takezo and Takuan kept his lordship company far into the night. They were joined by several of Terumasa's retainers, and eventually Takuan got to his feet and performed an ancient dance. He was expert, his vivid movements creating an imaginary world of delight. Takezo, now Musashi, watched with admiration, respect, and enjoyment as the drinking went on and on. The following day, they both left the castle. Musashi was taking his first steps into a new life, a life of discipline and training in the martial arts. During his 3-year incarceration, he had resolved to master the art of war. Takuan had his own plans. He had decided to travel about the countryside, and the time had come, he said, to part again. When they reached the town outside the castle walls, Musashi made as if to take his leave, but the monk grabbed his sleeve and said,
"Isn't there someone you'd like to see?"
"Who?
Ogin?
Is she still alive?" he asked in bewilderment.
Even in his sleep, he'd never forgotten the gentle sister who'd been a mother to him so long. Takuan told him that when he'd attacked the stockade at Hinagura 3 years earlier, Ogin had indeed already been taken away. Although no charges were pressed against her, she had been reluctant to return home, and so went instead to stay with a relative in a village in the Sayo district. She was now living comfortably there.
"Wouldn't you like to see her?" asked Takuan. "She's very eager to see you. I told her 3 years ago that she should consider you dead, since in one sense you were. I also told her, however, that after 3 years I'd bring her a new brother, different from the old Takezo."
Musashi pressed his palms together and raised them in front of his head, as he would have done in prayer before a statue of the Buddha. "Not only have you taken care of me," he said with deep emotion, "but you've seen to Ogin's well-being, too. Takuan, you are truly a compassionate man. I don't think I'll ever be able to thank you for what you've done."
"One way to thank me would be to let me take you to your sister."
"No. No, I don't think I should go.
Hearing about her from you has been as good as meeting her."
"Surely you want to see her yourself, if only for a few minutes."
"No, I don't think so. I did die, Takuan,
and I do feel reborn. I don't think that now is the time to return to the past. What I have to do is take a resolute step forward into the future. I've barely found the way along which I'll have to travel. When I've made some progress toward the knowledge and self-perfection I'm seeking, perhaps I'll take the time to relax and look back. Not now.
I see.
I find it hard to put into words, but I hope you'll understand anyway.
I do. I'm glad to see you're as serious about your goal as you are. Keep following your own judgment.
I'll say goodbye now, but someday, if I don't get myself killed along the way, we'll meet again.
Yes, yes. If we have a chance to meet, let's by all means do so.
Takuan turned, took a step, and then halted.
Oh yes, I suppose I should warn you that Osugi and Uncle Gong left Miyamoto in search of you and Otsu 3 years ago. They resolved never to return until they've taken their revenge, and, old as they are, they're still trying to track you down. They may cause you some inconvenience, but I don't think they can make any real trouble. Don't take them too seriously. Oh yes, and then there's Aoki Tanzaemon. I don't suppose you ever knew his name, but he was in charge of the search for you. Perhaps it had nothing to do with anything you or I said or did, but that splendid samurai managed to disgrace himself, with the result that he's been dismissed permanently from Lord Ikeda's service. He's no doubt wandering about too.
Takuan grew grave.
Musashi, your path won't be an easy one. Be careful as you make your way along it.
I'll do my best, Musashi smiled.
Well, I guess that's everything. I'll be on my way.
Takuan turned and walked westward. He didn't look back.
Keep well,
Musashi called after him. He stood at the crossroads, watching the monk's form recede until it was out of sight. Then, once again, alone, he started to walk toward the east. Now there's only this sword, he thought, the only thing in the world I have to rely on. He rested his hand on the weapon's handle and vowed to himself, I will live by its rule. I will regard it as my soul, and by learning to master it, strive to improve myself, to become a better and wiser human being. Takuan follows the way of Zen. I will follow the way of the sword. I must make of myself an even better man than he is. After all, he reflected, he was still young. It was not too late. His footsteps were steady and strong, his eyes full of youth and hope. From time to time he raised the brim of his basket hat and stared down the long road into the future, the unknown path all humans must tread. He hadn't gone far. In fact, he was just on the outskirts of Himeji, when a woman came running toward him from the other side of Hanada Bridge. He squinted into the sunlight.
It's you!
Otsu cried, clutching his sleeve. Musashi gasped in surprise. Otsu's tone was reproachful.
Takezo, surely you haven't forgotten. Don't you remember the name of this bridge? Did it slip your mind that I promised to wait here for you, no matter how long it took?
You've been waiting here for the last 3 years? He was astounded.
Yes.
Osugi and Uncle Gong caught up with me right after I left you. I was sick, and I had to take a rest. And I almost got myself killed, but I got away. I've been waiting here since about 20 days after we said goodbye at Nakayama Pass. Pointing to a basket weaving shop at the end of the bridge, a typical little high road stall selling souvenirs to travelers, she continued, I told the people there my story, and they were kind enough to take me on as a sort of helper, so I could stay and wait for you. Today is the 970th day, and I've kept my promise faithfully. She peered into his face, trying to fathom his thoughts.
You will take me with you, won't you?
The truth, of course, was that Musashi had no intention of taking her or anyone else with him. At this very moment, he was hurrying away to avoid thinking about his sister, whom he wanted to see so badly and felt so strongly drawn toward. The questions raced through his agitated mind. What can I do? How can I embark on my quest for truth and knowledge with a woman, with anyone, interfering all the time? And this particular girl is, after all, still betrothed to Matahachi. Musashi couldn't keep his thoughts from showing on his face.
Take you with me?
Take you where? He demanded bluntly.
Wherever you go.
I'm setting out on a long, hard journey, not a sightseeing trip.
I won't get in your way, and I'm prepared to endure some hardships.
Some? Only some?
As many as I have to.
That's not the point. Otsu, how can a man master the way of the samurai with a woman tagging along? Wouldn't that be funny? People would say, look at Musashi, he needs a wet nurse to take care of him.
She pulled harder at his kimono, clinging like a child.
Let go of my sleeve, he ordered.
No, I won't. You lied to me, didn't you?
When did I lie to you?
At the pass. You promised to take me with you.
That was ages ago. I wasn't really thinking then either, and I didn't have time to explain. What's more, it wasn't my idea. It was yours. I was in a hurry to get moving, and you wouldn't let me go until I promised. I went along with what you said because I had no choice.
No, no, no! You can't mean what you're saying. You can't!
She cried, pinning him against the bridge railing.
Let go of me! People are watching!
Let them! When you were tied up in the tree, I asked you if you wanted my help. You were so happy you told me twice to cut the rope. You don't deny that, do you?
She was trying to be logical in her argument, but her tears betrayed her. First abandoned as an infant, then jilted by her betrothed, and now this. Musashi, knowing how alone she was in the world and caring for her deeply, was tongue-tied, though outwardly more composed.
Let go, he said with finality. It's broad daylight and people are staring at us. Do you want us to be a sideshow for these busybodies?
She released his sleeve and fell sobbing against the railing, her shiny hair falling over her face.
I'm sorry, she mumbled. I shouldn't have said all that. Please forget it. You don't owe me anything.
Leaning over and pushing her hair from her face with both hands, he looked into her eyes.
Otsu, he said tenderly.
During all that time you were waiting, until this very day, I've been shut up in the castle dungeon. For 3 years, I haven't even seen the sun.
Yes, I heard.
You knew?
Takuan told me.
Takuan? He told you everything?
I guess so. I fainted at the bottom of a ravine near the Mikazuki tea house. I was running away from Osugi and Uncle Gong. Takuan rescued me. He also helped me make arrangements to work here at the souvenir shop. That was 3 years ago. And he stopped in several times. Only yesterday he came and had some tea. I wasn't sure what he meant, but he said, "It's got to do with a man and a woman, so who can say how it'll turn out?"
Musashi dropped his hands and looked down the road leading west. He wondered if he'd ever again meet the man who'd saved his life, and again he was struck by Takuan's concern for his fellow man, which seemed all-encompassing and completely devoid of selfishness. Musashi realized how narrow-minded he himself had been, how petty to suppose that the monk felt a special compassion for him alone. His generosity encompassed Ogin, Otsu, anyone in need whom he thought he could help.
It has to do with a man and a woman.
Takuan's words to Otsu sat heavily on Musashi's mind. It was a burden for which he was ill-prepared, since in all the mountains of books he'd pored over those 3 years, there wasn't one word about the situation he was in now. Even Takuan had shrunk from becoming involved in this matter between him and Otsu. Had Takuan meant that relationships between men and women had to be worked out alone by the people involved? Did he mean that no rules applied, as they did in the art of war? That there was no foolproof strategy, no way to win? Or was this meant as a test for Musashi, a problem only Musashi would be able to solve for himself? Lost in thought, he stared down at the water flowing under the bridge. Otsu gazed up into his face, now distant and calm.
"I can come, can't I?" she pleaded. "The shopkeepers promised to let me quit whenever I wish. I'll just go and explain everything and then pack my things. I'll be back in a minute."
Musashi covered her small white hand, which was resting on the railing, with his own.
"Listen," he said plaintively. "I beg of you, just stop and think." "What's there to think about?"
"I told you. I've just become a new man. I stayed in that musty hole for 3 years. I read books. I thought. I screamed and cried. Then suddenly the light dawned. I understood what it means to be human. I have a new name, Miyamoto Musashi. I want to dedicate myself to training and discipline. I want to spend every moment of every day working to improve myself. I know now how far I have to go. If you chose to bind your life to mine, you'd never be happy. There will be nothing but hardship, and it won't get easier as it goes along. It'll get more and more difficult. When you talk like that, I feel closer to you than ever. Now I'm convinced I was right. I've found the best man I could ever find, even if I searched for the rest of my life."
He saw he was just making things worse. "I'm sorry. I can't take you with me."
"Well, then, I'll just follow along. As long as I don't interfere with your training, what harm would it do? You won't even know I'm around."
Musashi could find no answer.
"I won't bother you. I promise."
He remained silent.
"It's all right then, isn't it? Just wait here. I'll be back in a second. And I'll be furious if you try to sneak away."
Otsu ran off toward the basket weaving shop. Musashi thought of ignoring everything and running too, in the opposite direction. Though the will was there, his feet wouldn't move. Otsu looked back and called,
"Remember, don't try to sneak off!"
She smiled, showing her dimples, and Musashi inadvertently nodded. Satisfied by this gesture, she disappeared into the shop. If he was going to escape, this was the time. His heart told him so, but his body was still shackled by Otsu's pretty dimples and pleading eyes. How sweet she was! It was certain no one in the world save his sister loved him so much. And it wasn't as though he disliked her. He looked at the sky. He looked into the water, desperately gripped the railing, troubled and confused. Soon, tiny bits of wood began floating from the bridge into the flowing stream. Otsu reappeared on the bridge in new straw sandals, light yellow leggings, and a large traveling hat tied under the chin with a crimson ribbon. She'd never looked more beautiful. But Musashi was nowhere to be seen. With a cry of shock, she burst into tears. Then her eyes fell upon the spot on the railing from which the chips of wood had fallen. There, carved with the point of a dagger, was the clearly inscribed message: "Forgive me. Forgive me."
Book 2. Water. The Yoshioka School. The life of today which cannot know the morrow. In the Japan of the early 17th century, an awareness of the fleeting nature of life was as common among the masses as it was among the elite. The famous General Oda Nobunaga, who laid the foundations for Toyotomi Hideyoshi's unification of Japan, summed up this view in a short poem. Man's 50 years are but a phantom dream in his journey through the eternal transmigrations. Defeated in a skirmish with one of his own generals, who attacked him in a sudden fit of revenge, Nobunaga committed suicide in Kyoto at the age of 48. By 1605, some 2 decades later, the incessant warring among the daimyo was essentially over, and Tokugawa Ieyasu had ruled as shogun for 2 years. The lanterns on the streets of Kyoto and Osaka glowed brightly, as they had in the best days of the Ashikaga shogunate, and the prevailing mood was light-hearted and festive. But few were certain the peace would last. More than 100 years of civil strife had so colored people's view of life that they could only regard the present tranquility as fragile and ephemeral. The capital was thriving, but the tension of not knowing how long this would last whetted the people's appetite for merrymaking. Though still in control, Ieyasu had officially retired from the position of shogun. While still strong enough to control the other daimyo and defend the family's claim to power, he had passed on his title to his 3rd son, Hidetada. It was rumored that the new shogun would visit Kyoto soon to pay his respects to the emperor, but it was common knowledge that his trip west meant more than a courtesy call. His greatest potential rival, Toyotomi Hideyori, was the son of Hideyoshi, Nobunaga's able successor. Hideyoshi had done his best to ensure that power remain with the Toyotomis until Hideyori was old enough to exercise it, but the victor at Sekigahara was Ieyasu. Hideyori still resided at Osaka Castle, and although Ieyasu, rather than have him done away with, permitted him to enjoy a substantial annual income, he was aware that Osaka was a major threat as a possible rallying point of resistance. Many feudal lords knew this too, and hedging their bets, paid equal court to both Hideyori and the shogun. It was often remarked that the former had enough castles and gold to hire every masterless samurai or ronin in the country, if he wanted to. Idle speculation on the country's political future formed the bulk of gossip in the Kyoto air.
"War is bound to break out sooner or later. It's just a matter of time.
These street lanterns could be snuffed out tomorrow."
"Why worry about it? What happens, happens.
Let's enjoy ourselves while we can."
The bustling nightlife and booming pleasure quarters were tangible evidence that much of the populace were doing just that. Among those so inclined was a group of samurai now turning a corner into Shijō Avenue. Beside them ran a long wall of white plaster, leading to an impressive gate with an imposing roof. A wooden plaque, blackened with age, announced in barely legible writing, "Yoshioka Kenpo of Kyoto, military instructor to the Ashikaga shoguns." The 8 young samurai gave the impression of having practiced sword fighting all day without respite. Some bore wooden swords in addition to the 2 customary steel ones, and others were carrying lances. They looked tough, the kind of men who'd be the first to see bloodshed the moment a clash of arms erupted. Their faces were as hard as stone, and their eyes threatening, as if always on the brink of exploding in a rage.
"Young master, where are we headed tonight?"
they clamored, surrounding their teacher.
"Anywhere but where we were last night," he replied gravely.
"Why? Those women were falling all over you. They barely looked at the rest of us."
"Maybe he's right," another man put in. "Why don't we try someplace new, where no one knows the young master or any of the rest of us?"
Shouting and carrying on among themselves, they seemed totally consumed by the question of where to go drinking and whoring. They moved on to a well-lit area along the banks of the Kamo River. For years, the land had been vacant and weed-filled, a veritable symbol of wartime desolation. But with the coming of peace, its value had shot up. Scattered here and there were flimsy houses,
red and pale yellow curtains hanging crookedly in their doorways where prostitutes plied their trade. Girls from Tamba province, white powder smeared carelessly on their faces, whistled to prospective customers. Unfortunate women who had been purchased in droves plunked on their shamisens, a newly popular instrument, as they sang bawdy songs and laughed among themselves. The